Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, we interview military historian, political analyst, and best-selling author Max Boot. His biography of President Ronald Reagan, titled Reagan, His Life and Legend, was published by Live Right in September 2024. Fellow biographer and Bio member John, better known as Jack Farrell, started this interview by asking Max Boot about what led him to Reagan and to his previous examination of the life of U.S. General and CIA official Edward Lansdale.
Max, how does a scholar, a military historian, an advisor to presidential candidates, editor, columnist, turn down this dark alley of biography? How did you first walk into an editor's office and say, hey, I'm going to do a biography of Ed Lansdale?
Well, I was going to say Ed Lansdale was kind of my gateway drug into the realm of biography. That book in turn grew out of my previous book, which was called Invisible Armies, which was a history of guerrilla warfare down through the ages. And I had a chapter or two on Lansdale in one of my editor and I at Norton, Bob Weil, and I were sitting around shooting the breeze talking about what I would do for an encore. He suggested expanding the section on Lansdale into a standalone book. And I was kind of initially skeptical, saying, well, haven't I already done that? But as I got into it, I found out, no, I really hadn't done it. It was kind of a lesson to me in how much you can really learn from digging into somebody's life beyond, you know, the common conceptions. And so on that book, I had this amazing find, which is any biographer's dream. I found these long lost love letters between Ed Lansdale and Pat Kelly, who was his longtime mistress and eventually became his second wife. And I was the first outsider to read those letters. And then I also had access to the letters that Lansdale wrote to his first wife, often at the same time as he was writing to Pat Kelly. And so I was truly the only person in the world other than Lansdale himself who read both sets of letters. And so it was an amazing vantage point and entree into Lansdale's inner thinking. And that really got me excited about doing this Lansdale book. And that was kind of my segue from just, you know, kind of doing, I did a bunch of military history books before that. That was kind of my segue. You know, Lansdale was kind of a military biography. And then I found out that I actually enjoyed the biography part of that more than I enjoyed the military history part of that. And so that's what led me to undertake this audacious task of writing a life of Ronald Reagan in 2013.
How did you come across the letters? Biographers are right now sitting there and some of us are green with envy, but we're also curious as to how you came upon them. And also, how did you breach the news to his existing family that this was going to be part of the book?
These are all great questions. The way I came across the letters was just happenstance. My research assistant and I were just tracking down the descendants of Pat Kelly, who again was this longtime mistress and eventually became a second wife. They didn't have kids together, but she had a daughter of her own with her first husband who died during World War II. And that daughter in turn had, you know, several grandchildren. And so I was tracking down the grandchildren and eventually wound up speaking to a couple of them, and including one who lived, it turns out, in Northern Virginia. So very easy to find. So I contacted her and I said, hey, I'd love to talk about your grandmother and the love of her life at Lansdale. And she said, oh, you know, I actually have all these letters between them. Would you be interested in that? And I had to kind of scrape my jaw off the floor. I said, are you kidding? And so then I went to her house in Northern Virginia, and she walks me down to the basement and has a ping pong table there and says, oh, here are their letters. And they're all like piled up there. And I actually have to like go through and start opening them. And it was just unbelievable. I was like, I couldn't believe my luck. You know, I was terrified that she would then deny me permission to use them or whatever. And then so at the behest of my publisher, I got her to sign a release. But she was, you know, very cool, very accommodating. And then I also met Ed Lansdale's kids. I mean, kids are, they're men in their 60s and 70s now, and they very happily shared letters that Lansdale had written to their mother. And of course, they knew all about Pat Kelly because eventually he married her after their mother died. And there were certainly some tensions there because these were like these two families that he had basically, and it's not like they were close. But Ed Lansdale himself was kind of a chill and laid back character, and I would say his children were also kind of chilled and laid back, and so they didn't mind at all that I was going to shed light on this other aspect of his life, including the years he spent cheating on their mother with Pat Kelly. And so I was very lucky to have this cooperation, but I was certainly very nervous. When I sent the book to the Lansdale boys, I was kind of nervous, like, what would they think of this? I mean, these were really, like, in some cases, fairly lurid love letters talking about, the spot behind her knee and all this other kind of stuff that people, in the throes of love tend to do. But they were perfectly okay with it.
Yeah, probably had the advantage of age. If they were younger, they may not have been.
Right.
And then what made you pick Ronald Reagan?
It was really because I thought I was kind of looking around and saying, who is a significant political figure who has not received a great biography? And so that leaves out people like Nixon that you and others have written about so well, and many others. But it kind of dawned on me that Reagan was kind of a subject hiding in plain sight because obviously he was hugely significant. I mean, I grew up in the 1980s. He was very consequential in my life and the life of the entire nation and the world. And there were a lot of books about Reagan, no question, but not really a great biography. And part of that was Edmund Morris, who was the commissioned biographer, seemed to have like a mental breakdown when he was writing about Reagan and produced this very bizarre quasi-fictional book called Dutch, in which he inserted himself as a character in Reagan's life. He even made up footnotes. I mean, I would say, as a work of history, it was somewhat worthless. It may have some value as a work of literature, but not as a work of history. And so I would say Edmund's failure kind of created my opportunity. And there were certainly other books, including Lou Cannon has written many very good books about Reagan, but they don't really quite add up to an entire biography. And I think there's also something about the passage of time. As you know, it takes a while to kind of figure out where a president stands in the American story and to put them in their proper perspective. And so I think, the passage of a few decades made that much easier for me. Also made it possible to see a lot of once declassified or just not available documents. There's a lot of stuff with the Reagan Library that previous people did not have access to. And I'm sure that in the future, obviously, there will be even more stuff declassified that future historians and biographers will have access to. But I think one advantage I had writing when I did was that while I did have access to a substantial amount of archival material, I also had access to a lot of people who actually knew Reagan and were still around, at least when I started a decade ago. George Shultz, Colin Powell, many others have sadly passed away. But I was lucky enough to be able to talk to a lot of those folks while they were still around and they were far enough away from events. I think they were able to speak more reflectively and less defensively than they might have done at the time.
So for our listeners, you are a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. You're a former op-ed editor at the Wall Street Journal, have a column at the Washington Post in addition to cranking out presidential biography. So it's quite impressive. And it's a wonderful book. And I also thought that the Lansdale book, particularly because you were able to pierce the distance behind this CIA guy, was very, very rich. And I it never ever lost my interest aside from the wonderful what ifs. If had anybody ever listened to Lansdale, what we might have saved in Vietnam.
Right.
Both these guys, Lansdale and Reagan, are trying to think of things they had in common, and they're both Californians, as are you, a graduate of Cal Berkeley. And do you think that there is a different perspective that you bring to their lives? Is there something that you know from the left coast that the rest of us don't, or just a way of looking at them that comes from your common heritage as a Californian?
It's a great question. That's actually one I've never been asked before. I'd have to think about that. Even though I've never been a political reporter or a political columnist, I do feel like I have some kind of visceral sense of California politics, just having grown up there and, covered it a little bit when I was a kid. I mean, like interning for the LA Times Sacramento Bureau or California Journal Magazine. I was interested in politics as a kid, so just watching growing up. So, I mean, that's more relevant to Reagan than Lansdale, because I mean, Lansdale went to school in UCLA and worked in San Francisco, but then moved on and it was not really connected to California, whereas Reagan obviously was very connected to California from the time he moved there in 1937 until his death in Bel Air. So, yeah, I mean, maybe I had some kind of extra feel for California having grown up there, but I'm not really sure how much insight that confers.
Now, flip that question a different way is that you are an emigre. You were born in Moscow in the Soviet Union, which is no longer with us. Does that give you a little bit of distance or perspective that those of us raised in middle America might not have about America when you write about it?
Maybe, although I mean, I came here when I was six, so I was raised in LA. I mean, I'm not Nabokov here. I'm not coming at this from the vantage point of an immigrant. I don't even speak Russian, so I'm actually, pretty American in my perspective. I think what has affected the way I view things is kind of my political outlook. And this is kind of indirectly related to where I was born, because certainly having been born in the Soviet Union, even coming here at a pretty young age, I was still tended, like a lot of people coming from communist countries, tended to gravitate towards the right side of the American political spectrum. And so I had a sympathy for Reagan growing up in the 80s as a kid in LA, and became a Republican, became a conservative, thrilled to a lot of his anti-communist rhetoric. And so, that certainly gave me part of my initial fascination with Reagan. But I think what was really helpful to me in terms of writing this biography, I really owe a huge debt to Donald Trump, because Trump's ascendancy in 2016 led me to re-register from Republican to independent, to leave the Republican Party and the conservative movement. And I think the Trumpist Republican Party is just as happy to have me gone. But, I think that was very helpful for me as a biographer, because I think if I were still writing from the vantage point of a Republican fan of Ronald Reagan, I don't think this would have been nearly as good of a book, because my vision would have been warped by affection for the subject. Whereas I think, leaving the Republican Party, I think, gave me an objectivity and a distance. I think that allowed me to write much more objectively about Reagan.
How does that distance work in today's book marketplace? It seems to me that there will be Reagan lovers and there will be Reagan haters. Did you find that there was room for a new objective down the middle, to use a word that you use in the book for Ronald Reagan, a pragmatic approach to his career?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I was lucky enough to make the New York Times bestseller list, and it's gotten very good reviews, which I've been very cheered by. But yeah, there's no question there are certainly some people, especially on the right, who think it's, you see the comments on Amazon and elsewhere, they think that it's too critical, that, how dare I criticize Reagan? But I think the reviews have generally said it's pretty down the middle. It criticizes him and it praises him, I think, kind of gives him his due, as well as calls him to account where necessary. So I think there is that audience for presidential biography, but maybe it would have sold more if it had just been, a Reagan hagiography. I don't know, but that's not the book I wanted to write. And it's not really a book I could write, because I wanted to see things, as I said, more objectively. And I think reviewers and a lot of readers that I've heard from have appreciated that perspective.
I think you began the book before the rise of Trump, the latest rise of
Yeah,
Trump.
it wasn't motivated by Trump. It had nothing to do with, I mean, when I
But
began it, nobody could have imagined he would become president.
right. But and yet there, but there are a lot of similarities. That "Make America Great Again" was a Reagan slogan. The magical thinking and use of big lies and small fibs, some of the dog whistle racism and gay bashing, and bottom line, a TV entertainer turned politician. So, as you were doing the research on Reagan and this other drama was unfolding and you were writing about it every day, what can you tell us about whatever link there is between Trumpism and Reaganism and whatever came before Reaganism?
Well, one thing I want to emphasize is I really did not want to make this book about the current political moment. I really wanted to keep the focus on Reagan, remembering that he died long before Trump came along as a political figure. But I also felt like you couldn't quite ignore the elephant in the room. And so what I did was I had a very brief mention of Trump in the introduction, just saying to what extent did Reagan lead to Trump. And then in the epilogue, I also had a very brief synopsis of my thoughts on that question, but I did not make this about Trump and kept him largely out of the actual book itself because he had nothing to do with Reagan's life. But certainly reading it, like, any other work of history, you read it in light of what's happening in the world today, and it kind of offers its own implicit commentary on events. And I don't think the writer has to necessarily draw that out. It's, I mean, it's kind of, it's there in the material. And I think you're right. I've been asked a lot about this, and I will say that it does give a hook to talk about Reagan because people want to know what's the connection between Reagan and Trump. And what I generally say is, look, I think the differences between Reagan and Trump are greater than the similarities, but there are continuities, and you just mentioned a bunch of them, including the white backlash politics, using faux facts, their backgrounds as entertainers, their populist stance, kind of bashing the government even as they're leading it, their economic policies that favor the wealthy. I think we can't like pretend that Reagan was a proto-Trump because, again, I think the differences are greater. I mean, remember, Reagan was a guy who was pro-immigration. I mean, he signed legislation that legalized millions of undocumented immigrants. He was pro-free trade. He was pro-NATO. He was anti-Russian aggression. And, fundamentally, I think temperamentally, he was just as different from Trump as can be because Reagan was a very positive, optimistic guy who always viewed America as a shining city on a hill and kind of had this relentlessly upbeat vision, would have never talked about, America as a garbage dump or whatever, language Trump uses. And Reagan was also extremely gentlemanly and courtly, would have never engaged in invective against his political opponents. As he worked closely with Tip O'Neill and other Democrats and believed in reaching across the aisle. He believed in the art of compromise, and that is certainly not Trump. So I suspect that if Reagan were still alive today, he would probably be seen as a rhino Republican in name only because he would be so much outside of what has become the Republican mainstream.
Yeah, I think that as I get older and as I watch Trump, I have much more appreciation for Roosevelt and JFK and Reagan as people who could speak to the best in Americans and give them the thrill, idealism. We are Americans, as Reagan used to say. And despite the fact that JFK, for example, had a very brief 1,000 days and the legislative accomplishments did not bear fruit until Lyndon Johnson. And after the assassination, just that ability to rally and drive a nation to revive its sense of idealism is important. And two things that I got out of your book was that this was one of Reagan's great accomplishments, that he, coming after all the problems with Vietnam and Watergate and the failures of the Carter administration, he gave us a sense that we could do big things again.
I think that's absolutely right. And one of the, for me anyway, one of the more fascinating chapters in the book was drawing the comparisons between Roosevelt and Reagan and talking about the way that Roosevelt influenced Reagan, because I was kind of startled to realize as I got into this how temperamentally similar Roosevelt and Reagan both were. And it was said of Roosevelt that he had a second-class intellect and a first-class temperament. And you could say exactly the same thing about Ronald Reagan because they were neither one of them was intellectual. Roosevelt was probably somewhat more intellectually curious than Reagan, but in both of their cases, their real strength was their character and their undying optimism and their ability to inspire others in the darkest of times, whether it was the Great Depression or the recession of the early 1980s. In both cases, they understood kind of the leadership component. The use of the bully pulpit as an essential part of the presidency. As Reagan was once asked something like, "How could an actor be president?" And his reply was, he didn't understand how anybody but an actor could be president. And that recalled the fact that a lot of people describe Roosevelt as an actor. And there is that performative aspect of the presidency that I think Roosevelt grasped probably better than anyone. And he was doing it at kind of the dawn of the mass media age when his medium of communications was radio. And of course, Reagan was one of millions of Americans who was sitting there listening to the fireside chats and was inspired by them and was intuitively learning this is how you communicate with a large audience. And Reagan himself was honing his skills at the same time as a radio broadcaster, in Iowa before moving on to Hollywood. And so I think it's not a coincidence that as president, Reagan was giving weekly radio addresses, which is not something that most modern presidents do, but he was really so influenced by Roosevelt. And even when he rejected Roosevelt's politics, he was still very much enthralled to Roosevelt's personality and his methods of communication.
Yeah. Did Reagan ever give him Roosevelt credit for the rendezvous with destiny line?
I don't think he was trying to hide where the line came from.
Where it came from,
it's
yeah.
pretty famous. I mean, I think it was kind of an implicit nod to not just to his youthful upbringing as a New Deal Democrat, but also it was a way for him to bridge the partisan divide and to appeal to the Reagan Democrats.
Yeah, he was very good at that. The other great claim for greatness, I think, that the book makes for Reagan is the handling of the Cold War. But it's not idolatry. It's not Ronald Reagan got into the White House and immediately did two or three things that caused the wall to fall. It is a much more sort of nuanced and textured look about how he dealt with the then Soviet Union, right?
Yeah, no, it's 100% correct. I mean, I give him a lot of credit for the end of the Cold War, but I give him credit for very different things than most of his fans do, because I talk about in the subtitle of the book, Reagan, His Life and Legend. And one of the enduring legends around Reagan is that he bankrupted and brought down the Soviet Union with his defense buildup, with SDI, with support to the Afghan Mujahideen and the Nicaraguan Contras. And as I try to show in the book, that's largely a myth. I mean, his first term foreign policy towards the Soviet Union was very tough. I mean, he was calling the Soviet Union the evil empire and doing all these other things, but it wasn't producing peace and it wasn't leading to the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was actually ratcheting up tensions and producing this series of very scary war scares in 1983. You know, at that point, he decided to pull back and realize that he was playing a dangerous game. And he did want to meet with Soviet leaders, but as he kept saying, they kept dying on me. And it was only in 85, when Mikhail Gorbachev came to power, that he suddenly had a partner for peace in the Soviet Union. And all of a sudden, lo and behold, his policy towards the Soviet Union becomes much more successful. And it's not because Gorbachev felt like, you know, he needed to end the Cold War because he was losing, or the Soviet side was losing. Gorbachev didn't want to engage in the Cold War at all. He thought it was a waste of money and resources. And, you know, he actually wanted a better life for Soviet citizens and knew he couldn't do that while they were spending all this money on defense spending. So, as I point out in the book, I mean, if somebody other than Gorbachev had come to power in 85 in the Soviet Union, Reagan would not have had a successful second term foreign policy. And it's likely the Soviet Union would still exist. I mean, imagine if somebody like Putin had come to power. I mean, he would not be dismantling the Soviet system in the way that Gorbachev did. I mean, I think what Reagan deserves credit for is not for bringing Gorbachev to power, because he didn't. And Reagan is not responsible for Gorbachev's reforms, which ultimately brought down the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union. But I think what Reagan does deserve credit for was understanding that Gorbachev was a different kind of communist leader, somebody he could deal with, as Mrs. Thatcher told him, and forging this relationship with Gorbachev that allowed the ratcheting down of tensions, reducing nuclear weapons, and paving the way for the end of the Cold War. And that's, to me, is a tremendous achievement, because it meant that he had to basically jettison decades of his own anti-communist ideology and work with the world's number one communist at a time when a lot of people, including his defense secretary, Kap Weinberger, were telling him he was being snookered. But, you know, he kept right on doing it. And I think he was vindicated. So it's kind of ironic that he does deserve a lot of credit for what happened with the end of the Cold War, but it's just not the credit that so many of his followers want to give him.
Yeah. Sometimes when I give talks, people will ask me about who was the greatest Cold War president. And I always answer that they all were. It's just astonishing that we navigated that period. But, I would go along with you that Reagan deserves a key part of the credit for seizing the moment, just as Nixon seized the moment when China was ready.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it was sort of interesting for me to write about Nixon and detente, because, of course, Reagan became this outspoken foe of detente in 1976 when he was running against Gerald Ford for the Republican nomination. And so people kind of assumed he was opposed to the detente from the beginning. And I discovered, no, he really wasn't, because he was such a big Nixon fan that basically anything Nixon did, he was going to support, including the outreach to Mao Zedong and Brezhnev, the openings to China and the Soviet Union. Reagan was supportive of all that and supportive of Nixon winding down the Vietnam War in a way that we were kind of guaranteed to lose. And Reagan thought of himself as being Nixon's successor. So he thought basically that he would support Nixon. Nixon would serve two terms and then Reagan would take over. And so he was shocked and, you know, 1974 when Nixon has to resign and Ford becomes president. And his basic reaction was, who is this pipsqueak usurping my position at the top of the party? And he had no respect for Ford. Ford had no respect for him. And so that set up this grudge match in 76. And as part of that, Reagan increasingly emphasized his opposition to Ford's foreign policy, which was really a continuation of the Nixon foreign policy that he had supported in the past.
Yeah, although you can't say that it was a two-way street because Nixon comes across on the tapes as being very dismissive of Reagan.
Yes, no, it's very funny because Reagan had, endless respect for Nixon and his acumen and all that kind of stuff. And then you listen to the tapes of Kissinger and Nixon sitting around the Oval Office and talking about what a dunce Reagan was, and Christ, he doesn't understand a goddamn thing about the world, Henry, and all this kind of stuff. It was very amusing that it was the respect was not returned. And I also read a lot of Nixon consulted with Reagan pretty regularly throughout his presidency and left memos about that. And he was also very dismissive of Reagan in those circumstances, say like, wow, this guy is not up to dealing with Gorbachev. We need a tough guy. He doesn't. It was not a mutual respect. It was truly one way. But I think the funny thing about Reagan is one of his hidden strengths was that he could be so clueless, and there were so many people around him who had so little respect for him, including many of his own aides, other world leaders, people like Nixon, who basically like mocked him behind his back, rolled their eyes, thought he wasn't really intellectually fit to be president. And you could imagine if it was somebody like Nixon or Trump or somebody like that who had people around him mocking him or like disrespecting him, they would go ballistic, and he would vow revenge, and he would get those so-and-sos and whatever. But Reagan was almost completely oblivious and so good-natured that even if he was aware of it, he didn't actually care. And so his life and presidency were not disfigured by this kind of resentment and envy that I think were really driving forces for Nixon and Trump.
Is there something about the United States that we have these recurring waves of shifts to the right?
Gosh, that's a great question. That's a hard one to answer. I mean, I think certainly our political system gives disproportionate power to concentrated minorities. So all these small states throughout the South and Mountain West that Republicans control gives them an outsized impact in the Electoral College and in the Senate. I mean, if we were electing presidents based just on the popular vote, Trump would have beaten Kamala Harris, but he would have lost by a big margin to Hillary Clinton in 2016. But it's certainly true that right-wing populism is not just a force in the US, it's a force all over the world, from Brazil to France to, just about any other country you could name, India. So I think in times of turmoil and change, and we always live in times of turmoil and change, in times of immigration and mass migration, I think there's always that appeal to kind of a right-wing populist message of, our nation is being threatened by outsiders. We need to return to the imaginary good old days. And, I would say outside of Latin America, you don't see that much left-wing populism that really resonates with voters, whereas right-wing populism seems to be pretty universal in its appeal.
Do the subjects of your biographies appear in your dreams while you're working on them?
I certainly become obsessed with them. I think about them a lot, for sure. I mean, it does feel like you're living with another person, no question about it.
Well, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Really
Thanks.
enjoyed it.
That was best-selling author Max Boot speaking with fellow biographer Jack Farrell about his latest book, Reagan, His Life and Legend. It was published by LiveRight in September 2024, and this interview was recorded via Zoom on December 9th of this year. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Alani Hodge created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a fantastic day.